I want to welcome everyone. I'm Stephen Hamburg. I'm the chief scientist at EDF, and it's really my honor and pleasure to be joined by Stephen Pakala, distinguished professor at Princeton, EDF trustee, and I'm proud to be able to say a co-conspirator on many things related to climate. We've done a lot of work over the past decade together. And what we'd like to do is start with just really fairly brief introductory remarks. I'll take it off and then Steve will join in. But really want to make this a conversation. So do think about what are the questions you have about climate change? Where are your things that are perplexing, worrying, or hopefully even optimistic? Because we really do want to make a conversation. We want to try and engage and really try and stimulate all of us, because this is a collective problem we all face, and it will be only solved with a set of collective solutions that we all engage in. I got involved in climate change work and thinking about it from an EDF trustee, a founding trustee, George Woodwell, when I was an undergraduate. And I'll just leave it at more than 40 years ago. And he introduced me to the problem. I was a student, and I thought, okay, this is going to happen. It's interesting. And I pretty much forgot about it. And then I started working in forests. I'm a forest ecologist. And I had a complex data set I couldn't understand. And that was more than 30 years ago. And I wasn't smart enough at the time to recognize the signal of climate change, but I had a great colleague, Charlie Cogbill, and I gave him the paper looking at sort of trends in forests, and he said, Steve, it's climate. Can't you see it? And he was right. And so I also can attribute climate to getting tenure, because that was in Nature. It was one of the first papers showing the impacts of climate on forests. And I spent most of my career as an academic. But I left academia to come to EDF because I really care about climate and other things, but in particular climate and its impacts. And as we all know, as we've seen recently, the impacts are getting very visible. It may have been a little harder to see in the mid-1980s, but that same forest that I characterized with the impacts, I'm seeing the influence now in ways that I could not predict then. There happens so much more rapidly. So if we think about what we see in front of us, we see a world that's changing ever faster. We've got a series of recent reports that paint a pretty dire picture. So we need to find a way forward that doesn't deny those things, because they're real, and they really are. I can see them in my own research, not just in the record. I can see the changes over my lifetime in the long-term plots I've maintained. So we need to figure out how to do that, whether we're sitting here in San Francisco and we're seeing the incredibly horrible fires and droughts and other influences. We're seeing the scientific reports out of the IPCC, National Climate Assessment. We're seeing that what we thought would be tolerable of 2 degrees C might not be for total change. Maybe we've got to get closer to 1.5. And all of that's painting a picture that feels pretty hard to bear. And yet, I am optimistic. And I'm optimistic because I think we have far more tools in front of us than we've recognized. It won't be easy. The damages will be great. The impacts will be there. That's not an if. It's how bad. And so we need to think about how to begin to employ those solutions while we prepare for those impacts. And not just here in the wonderful place we're in and the affluence of the United States, but across the globe. And I'm going to turn it over, because I promised to be brief, to Steve, who will sort of outline some of the things we've worked on. But then I'd really like to explore with you about these issues. So start to think about the things that are really pressing and push back. After 25 years in the classroom, I'm always disappointed if I don't get into a good intellectual fight. So with that, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Good evening, everyone. Like Steve, I work on both the impact side of climate change and the solution side. And that's good, because everybody I know who works on impacts is bummed out all day, every day, all day long. And, you know, the news is just relentless and relentlessly bad. We discover more and more damages, not fewer and fewer. We have to tighten our targets, like from 2 to 1.5 degrees, not loosen them. And the progress that we see out there, certainly in this nation, is not encouraging right now. And so it's tough being a climate impact scientist. On the other hand, on the solution side, and it's almost unchronicled, the picture is very much the opposite. And in the last 5 years, there has been an unrecognized revolution in the availability of solutions that doesn't have a precedent in previous human history, at least not in the energy space. And so that it is now possible for us, if we choose to do so, for instance, in the United States, to swap our emitting energy economy for a non-emitting one, say over 30 years, and leave consumers with about what they pay today. And this is just a sea change. And so it makes me really, really, really optimistic about our future, because finally we have the tools to do something about this. You know, it's terrible when you know something's awful and you actually don't have the tools that you need. We do have the tools now. So I want to talk just a little bit about what those tools are. And in doing so, I also want to sort of tell the story about EDF. I'm a scientist. I'm an independent scientist. I'm not an EDF employee. I'm also, if I do say so myself, extremely good at raising funds. So I don't need money from anybody, least of all EDF.
And I guarantee you, we don't pay him. He volunteers.
And the question is, why do I volunteer? I give a huge amount of heavy lifting time to EDF, and I want to tell you why. Okay, so the core of the solution to the carbon and climate problem is three simple buckets. The first bucket is zero carbon electricity, most of it renewable. And with electrification of the light and medium duty vehicle fleets, wind and solar are the cheapest forms of energy by a long shot in the right location. And they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. This is a fundamental change. And there are batteries that you can drive that will drive cars now. All the major manufacturers are planning, the automotive manufacturers are planning on an electric future. Okay, so this is a way to transfer a large segment of the emitting economy to a non-emitting one. There's a second bucket, though, and the problem with an all-renewable economy is that the lights don't always go on, because the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And you can level some of it with batteries, but we don't have the batteries we need yet to do the whole job. So you need some source of firm power, power that you can make whenever you want. And the carbon and climate problem is serious enough that I think we have to implement what we have now, go to market with what we have. And the cheapest form of firm power is natural gas with carbon capture and storage technology. Pull CO2 from the flue stream and put it back into the kinds of reservoirs that you got the gas from. The third bucket is negative emissions, and we could talk about that. There are some sources that are really very, very difficult to clean up. Like, for instance, some of the emissions of a gas, N2O, from fertilizer are kind of necessary to grow the food we need, all right? And so we have to offset those with negative emissions, and we have a bunch of different ways of doing that now. So I want to focus back on natural gas for a minute, because, you know, it's a dangerous fossil fuel. Not only is it a fossil fuel, but the primary component is methane. And methane itself is a much more dangerous greenhouse gas than CO2 pound for pound in the atmosphere. It's 120 times more radiatively potent in the atmosphere pound for pound than is CO2. And so if you try to implement a solution that involves natural gas and any of it escapes, even 1% or 2% of it escape during production, distribution, end use, all the stuff that you have to do with it, it can undo everything that you're trying to do. So EDF, seeing this a long way off, decided to do something about that. And what they did was first to demonstrate in the United States that emissions were much higher than what we thought they were, and to characterize where those emissions were coming from, primarily from the production platforms where you produce them, where the drills are.
So this is emissions of methane.
Emissions of methane, yeah. The gas we're trying to keep in the pipe, right? And then they organized a group of oil and gas companies to agree
50 of them
unilaterally to a target, which is 0.2% of their production would go to the atmosphere. Now I want to talk about how stringent that is. If the entire world were to go to 0.2% with a verifiable target, it would take out 65 million tons of methane emissions annually, and that by itself is one-third of the distance between 1.5 and 2 degrees. Okay? Now, EDF has a program that is too intricate and beautiful for me to describe in full. But it also it includes amazing stuff, like a privately funded satellite that will go up and monitor global emissions. And so it's the only example like it. And as a bang for the buck, there's never been anything like it. A third of the distance between 1.5 and 2 degrees from a relatively small NGO without government intervention. And so I invest in EDF because of the return on my investment. Right? It's the highest return I can get if I want to have an impact in the environmental space that's beyond my sort of academic science.
Thanks, Steve. And we got to what Steve described. He was a little modest in that he was an integral player in that methane story. The very first calls about this, and I'll describe it as recognizing this big lever out there on the climate problem, but it's invisible to everyone and it's starting to take shape. And one of the first people I called as I started to think about that was Steve. And together we thought through and recognized that power of that lever. And then with hundreds of scientists across the country, and literally hundreds, we produced a body of scientific literature that proved that out to be the case. And then with a group of dedicated staff at EDF working with across these dozens and dozens of companies to get them to realize that their future hung on doing far better than they were doing and that we had the data to show they weren't doing well. And the satellite will be the big thing. I was in an all-day meeting yesterday. I'll be in one tomorrow. We've got two commercial firms competing to build it right now, and we'll launch it in 2021, and we'll be able to see the methane emissions from every oil and gas producer in the world and quantify it. That's about what... Okay, 1 second. We'll get to cattle in a minute. So we'll get to that in a second. Cattle are important, but we need to do it quickly. And as Steve said, reducing methane emissions quickly allows us to slow the rate of warming now while we invest. It's an and, it's not an or, in decarbonizing the entire economy, which we have to do. And we can slow that rate of warming, which means that I always frame it as, for myself and my daughter, I've got one daughter, we got to do the methane. And for my grandchildren's grandchildren, we got to take care of CO2. It's an and. But the key is keeping that temperature down now, looking for those levers that are hidden. And what Steve described is this growing movement of recognizing there are more of them out there. It's not going to be easy. But rather than 15 years ago when those levers weren't visible and it was looking like it was a really impossible task, we're now seeing the possible. Not the easy, not the simple, but the possible. And for me, that's why I gave up tenure and a professor to come work at EDF, because I wanted to make the possible a reality. So with that, let's open it up. We can talk about cattle if you want, but whatever. Got a question here?
So, yes, I'd love a few details. Specifically, I know I heard that the reported levels of escape of methane were much lower than the actual. So whatever data you have on what the actual level is now, You mentioned my second question, which was enforcement. How are we actually going to know? So a little more detail on the timing of the satellite and having the data. And then just a couple of key things about what the kinds of investments are that bring back the escape gap.
Sure. So I'll just summarize it. We are going to try and pass mics so everybody can hear the questions. So do wait if you got a question for the mic. So there were three parts. One, that the emissions were actually lower than reported. Two, they're higher. Okay, I thought you said it the other way. They are higher than they reported. That's correct. I was going to otherwise turn it around. So I just you had it right then, and I heard it wrong. They're higher than reported. How will we observe it, and what kinds of investments need to make the difference? So the first is the emissions in the United States, which we now know better than any place in the world by far. We published a paper in Science Magazine, which is one of the top science journals my team did, along with 25 other co-authors. Steve was a co-author on it, showing that the current emissions from the oil and gas supply chain, not including end use, what you do in your house or in the factory, is about 2.3%. Which means that when you burn natural gas, as I do in my boiler at home in Providence, and it's running hard tonight because it's in the single digits, if not the negative digits right now, it roughly doubles the climate impact over 20 years from the methane, from the burning, the CO2 that comes off. So that's the state of play. We believe that's probably representative of the globe, maybe a little lower, but nobody has that data. So we're in the middle of leading a whole series of studies around the globe, joint with the UN and a group of oil and gas companies. We don't take any money from the oil and gas, but I'm the chief scientific officer for this UN project, and we are doing studies currently in Europe, the Middle East. We just completed one in Mexico, but we've got a whole series of them in process or about to tee up. And we just need to find out the answer on that. How will we monitor? Well, the satellite's key to that, right? These studies are intense. We've got scientists now, not just in the United States, elsewhere, collecting this kind of data. But we can only look at a certain number of times and a certain number of places. And, of course, I have politely requested the ability to go to Russia to make these measurements numerous times, and you can imagine what the answer has been. So I don't think I'm going to get that permission, though. We haven't given up. We're still trying. And then in terms of what kinds of things you need to do, it's basic.
And then say something that Steve's not allowed to say. Years ago, I was the head of a project that was designing a verification system for the State Department and the intelligence community. One of the things we did was to get a satellite cleared to build that could see domes of CO2-enriched air over megacities. And so we announced it, and the next week the Chinese changed their negotiating position on verification and monitoring. And here, the great thing about a satellite is that it exposes what everyone is doing. And if you have some companies that have signed on to third-party independent verification that they have clean natural gas and others don't have, then there's the opportunity to have a price differential that forces it to be more expensive to be dirty than to be clean. And so there is a method to this. And, you know, he mentioned Russia. I didn't.
And so on the last, what does it do to take to clean it up for that 2.3% to get down to the 0.4 or something? Because the 0.2 is for the upstream, and we include some of the other parts. So that would be basically a 1/6, so 5/6 reduction, or 80%. Most of what you have to do, they're already doing. So when we go to a site, a third of the sites, when we look at them, are pretty darn clean. They're in that. And the key is paying enough attention to get the sites that aren't to do it. It's a host of different things, but the solutions are all there, already being implemented. The key was to get the industry to recognize they have a problem, and the sites and the companies to recognize where the problem is, and there's enough of a cost that at least half of that can be done at no net cost, but it takes the mental focus. So we're confident it can be done. The companies have agreed to those targets because they also believe it can be done. They wouldn't. They've done it out public. So roughly, the companies that have signed on to that pledge, that amount, is roughly half of global production. So it's a big deal. Now we got to work with them.
Distribution also.
So
that's the most important part of it, in my understanding, is the leaks in pipelines.
It's actually not.
Oh, it's not.
So we've mapped. If you go to edf.org, you can see the location and size of leaks in local distribution systems across 15 studies in the United States. Joint with Google, we developed the technology and the science algorithms to quantify and map local distribution. Critically important, we do it. So I'm not saying it's not important, but on a mass basis, it is not the dominant part. All right, so we got to do it. I'm not saying otherwise. But the upstream, the drilling, the gathering lines, the stuff there is the dominant. Not all of it. We got to clean. That's why I didn't say 0.2, which is what they committed to the upstream. I doubled it to 0.4 because recognizing that we have it, and it's about getting better pipeline replacement, doing it more quickly. And we've been working across cities with public utility commissions and various utilities to get them to basically allow them to make money, do the pipeline replacements, prioritize the repairs. No extra cost with the technology that we developed with folks at Colorado State. You can half the leak rate with the exact same investment in repair by simply knowing where the bigger leaks are. That's all we get. We gave them the information. Priority. Start here at the high ones and work your way down. Same amount, costs same amount, and you've halved the leaks. Now you invest some more, which I think they should do, and you can get it even lower. You replace the right pipes, and you can get it lower again. Yeah.
I'm encouraged by what you've said so far. And I think in the future, a lot of the success to control, to mitigate climate change is going to be due to political will. I don't perceive the political will in the United States with our current administration, but could you comment upon what you perceive the political will in the rest of the world is for climate change?
Do you want to take that one, Steve? I've been doing most of the talking.
Well, sure. There's an international agreement called the Paris Agreement, and all but like every nation in the world is a part of it, and the U.S. still is too. Not allowed to leave until after the 2020 election, so we'll see whether or not we leave it. All right, but there's been tremendous progress on the international front, and what encourages me is the increasing availability of solutions that are cost competitive with what we have now. All right, that's really the key to keeping the ball rolling. In the United States, we've got a really bad case of recidivism, right? And we'll see where that goes. But I can tell you that inside Congress, there's a real hunger to do something about this. And inside Republican circles, there is growing awareness, and not just one or two, but really substantial awareness that it's that a pivot is necessary. All right, and so one can never know what's going to happen in the United States. But if the 2020 election comes out the way the polling is currently indicating, I think we really could. We have a chance. All right, we have a chance not just to get back on board, but to lead the world here.
And here in California, you've taken some important steps in that with SB 100 and the 100% clean energy, right? Making the distinction, that's a great leadership role for the state of California. It's not going to be easy, so it's not going to be easy anywhere, but there is some hope there, and then we'll move over here.
I have a question about the long-term consequences for every technology solution lately. We seem to have had some unintended consequences, like what do we do with the solar panels when they get old? What do we do with nuclear waste after it's not useful? What do we do with batteries, with ion, you know, all the chemicals in them? It's nice to have zero emissions, but right now our technology is leaving us with many unanswered questions. And I was wondering, what do we do about that?
Make no mistake, the carbon and climate problem is a horrific problem. The amount that we emit as a species is staggering. The amount of CO2 you personally emit through your daily life is enough to bury a couple Cadillacs worth of CO2s in your yard every year. All right? It's tons and tons and tons for each American. And so there is no problem that, and moreover, the problem itself looks existential, right? It could actually, it's, in my view, the most serious environmental problem. And so all the problems that you talked about are important. There is no solution as big as the one that solves global warming has to be that doesn't have other consequences that we don't want. It's just, in my firm view, and we could talk about the particulars, none of the problems that you mentioned imperils the future of humanity in anything close to the way that uncontrolled global warming does. That simple.
And exactly.
So it's a bitter pill, but it is.
And there are things that we can do. We have to do them. We have to recognize it. Just like people push back. If you have to live right next to a very large wind turbine and it's too close, it's industrial in scale, you're not going to be happy, understandably. So you got to make, even with renewable, you got to do it well. You got to place it right. You got to minimize the impact and mitigate
on the other hand, if you have children and grandchildren, then do what my wife and I did with ours. And that is, every time you see a well-sited turbine, wind turbine, stop and say, my goodness, isn't that beautiful? Because aesthetics are malleable, and it actually worked. You know, I got to tell you, my kids think they're beautiful.
Over. I know there's a lot of questions.
I'll try to be brief. I'm interested in hearing your views on the permafrost in particular. You know, I'm worried about us getting to that kind of cuspy level where the permafrost tipping point, basically. And what other solutions besides reducing, you know, CO2 and trying to keep the warming, greenhouse gas emissions and trying to keep the warming in check. Are there any other solutions to keep the permafrost from melting?
Well, I can start on that. So the good news is it's a real concern. Absolutely. The good news is the current data is not indicative that that we're already seeing it. And if we can do one of the big things, right, keep the rate down as we talked about, take the 1.5 degrees or something like that. So we're already at 1, so we're not that far away. That's what's scary about it. There's a reasonable chance we can avoid that tipping point. We got to monitor it, and we got to do everything we can as fast as we can. And that's where, again, working on short-lived pollutants like methane, because the advantage of methane, and one of the reasons it's so powerful, is that its average lifetime is just roughly a decade. So if we stop emitting it, we see the benefits quickly. CO2 is up there for hundreds of years, so the trouble is we're stuck with it, is that we can reduce the rate of warming and thus the probability in our lifetime while we're pushing down the CO2. So we have a lot better chance then of avoiding those kinds of tipping points.
So what we're seeing really, and I'm so glad it's being emphasized here, is that making energy, no matter how you do it, is a filthy process. And it creates heat, it creates CO2, it creates methane. It ain't easy. There is no perfect solution. And we might find out we shouldn't be making energy and changing the way we consume. You know, that's probably going to be one of the major solutions. I just wanted to go back to my area and talk about some very serious problems that are very simple to solve. One are the poles, particularly the Arctic. I go to maritime conferences, and there's a lot of, call them Scandinavian companies, that are very interested in creating ships that go up there and break up the ice, as if it's not bad enough. I have two friends that sled, a couple, to the North Pole and were waiting to get picked up, and they both fell through the ice. And now they're both back in near London, okay? But in other words, it was so soft up there that you could fall through the ice, the North Pole. That's really very sad. And then there should be your eyes and ears trying to get these guys to stop breaking up the ice and creating ships that can go do that. It's to get through and have transport, but it's also a process that's very negative. And secondly, my very personal concern, I'd like to point this out to you, and I'll be quick, and maybe you have some comments, are ships. They say that 6 to 8 of the largest ships in the world create more pollution than all the cars, all the trucks, and all the trains.
And it's not true. It's not true.
Okay, well, we can talk about that because it's a very common statistic now. Observation.
So shipping is an important component, absolutely. But if we take all the all the cars and trucks, it's a much bigger problem. So let's say in the United States, where we're the second largest polluter, that transport piece is the largest source of greenhouse gases, bigger than electricity right now. Ships are not. Now, ships are a little complicated because historically they burn dirty fuel. Okay. The challenge there is they also emitted a lot of sulfur because of dirty fuel. That's bad.
Sucks.
But sulfur's a cooler. So they've been masking the effects of the CO2 they've been putting off. So the net effect on the climate has actually been less from shipping. And there's now mandates to clean up that sulfur for good reason. It's a pollutant. It's a problem. But it will make that pollution worse, and thus decarbonizing shipping becomes more important because now we're making the impacts greater.
Well, it's going to happen in 2020 and in 2050. It's happening. It's going to happen. So that's encouraging.
We should
by law, EU.
Move it there, and okay, got one there. Okay, well, whatever.
Okay.
I know. We'll get you next.
All right.
I promise.
Okay.
We'll move over.
So, my question has to do with population growth. So, to me, the growth of the economy is related to the growth of the human population, which, you know, when I was born was 3 billion people, yet less than it is now. So, you know, if we can't control the population, how can we control the economic growth that goes to try to make the population live at what we think is a reasonable level of economic and social health?
So population is a critical factor, but there is, and this is now I'm wearing not my EDF hat, my old academic hat. So remember, if you increase the affluence, the rate of reproduction drops precipitously. And the biggest, most powerful thing is education. There's a lag. But the other thing there's a lag on is you get better health care and you live longer, and that has an effect as well. I don't think any of us want to advocate to not improve health care so we all die sooner. So there's an intricate balance there. There's something called the IPAD equation, which now most demographers don't think. It was nice. Impact times population. Population times technology affects impact, and that it's just a straight equation. Societal values makes a big difference, and that's not a fixed relationship. So one of the things you can look to is how do you change how you consume energy and the impacts you have. Not all cultures are created equal by a long shot. So you're absolutely right. Population matters a lot, but don't think that if you have affluence, that's always a negative because it does drop. Look at Japan. Their population's shrinking dramatically, as does much of Europe.
Yeah.
And most of our replacement rate.
When Paul Ehrlich down the peninsula here wrote The Population Bomb, the data was just terrifying. And since that time, nation after nation has fallen to zero and then negative population growth. The Spanish and the Italians and the Russians have a population growth rate such that is negative, right? And each generation is half the size of the one before. If they were species, they would be endangered, all right? And so, so it is true that this is an important problem, but it is also true that UN projections of population show a maximum population size and a decline as a continuation of existing trends for that reason. And so this is a problem. It's an important problem, but it's a problem that's on its way to solving itself with a population that's large, right? There's no question about that. But again, this is not the kind of problem that it was when I was a child. Okay.
Hello. Thank you. And congratulations on the satellite. I love that story. And I have a question about the satellite being private. Sometimes I get afraid of the mail, the U.S. mail going away, and it's only going to be FedEx and UPS. So I just wonder, in the satellite world and what you're doing, do you have mechanisms where private companies aren't going to control it all and, you know, hide some stuff? Or, you know, like, how does that work when you've got a private satellite? I'd love to hear more about that.
So our satellite will be private in the sense that it's not government-owned. But I'll just tell you a little anecdote of how we approach this problem that I think will illustrate and hopefully make you feel a little better. So I was in Washington. I lead the methane sat project. I was in Washington because you need a license to put a satellite up. And I was there having our initial conversations about that license. And some of the regulators asked, so who's your customer? And our answer was, everybody. We're not selling anything. We're giving 100% of the data away. Everything will be transparent. We think there's a new norm out there where you put these kinds of satellites up, whether it's government or whatever, and all the data is transparent and available. So you, anybody, when we have that website up, any one of you can go to it. You can look up. You'll see maps of methane emissions, where it's coming from. It'll be fully available to everybody.
And who's making sure that, like, you're not blacking out stuff?
We've made a commitment to not black it out, and we've made a commitment, and we have, I guarantee you, all of our collaborators and all of our scientists and everybody.
Like hundreds of people, basically.
There are many. Yeah, I haven't added it up, but we're already probably at 100 people working on this project.
A wiki satellite.
Yeah, that's one way. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yes, that's the concept, right?
And make no mistake, this is just the first such satellite. It's coming in time to actually, it'll be the one that cracks the problem, but there will be government satellites that do this. There will be other private satellites. It's really difficult to maintain a scientific conspiracy when the whole endeavor is adversarial, right? You're always trying to prove everybody else is wrong except for you.
And we've done this before. So I mentioned the methane mapping. We did this project we did with Google to look at methane leaks in cities. No one had ever posted. Somebody had posted concentrations in Boston. That was it. A great research group at BU, but there'd never been public data like this. I was yelled at by many people saying we're going to create panic by putting this kind of data out public. We had a commitment to make all the data public. We've done it. All the data comes down. We process it. We have arrangement. The moment we touch it, it's ours. Google doesn't own it, and we provide 100% transparency. Now that some of the utilities start to put their own data public because they want to be ahead of the curve. So we think that there's a real revolution here, and we can help lead it, where this kind of data can be public. We're also doing it in Oakland on the other side, where we put all the air quality data public at the level of every 100 feet. You can go on our website, find the maps, look at what the pattern is. You can see what's higher, lower, whatever. We're working with the mayor of London to do exactly the same thing. We just announced 2 weeks ago with the mayor. We're leading that effort. We're mapping in London at the scale of every 30 meters, every 100 feet, and it'll show it. It'll 100% transparent. All the data will be there. We think that's the new norm, and we have to start catalyzing people to do that. So I promised we'd go over here.
On the question of political will, what does EDF view, the relative promise of sort of traditional regulation to deal with greenhouse gases as opposed to putting a price on carbon and letting that do its market magic thing?
I'm looking over there to Eric if he wants to answer that for it. We're scientists here. Are you willing to take that one, Eric? Introduce yourself first, please.
Put me on the spot, Steve. I'm Eric Pooley. I'm a senior vice president at EDF. So we don't think that any one policy is going to, you know, magically solve everything. We think it's going to be a suite of policies. But we think that putting a price and a limit on carbon pollution is the most important thing that we can do. So what do I mean by price and limit? Well, if you just have a price and you say, well, from now on, emitting a ton of CO2 is going to cost you $40 a ton, nobody has the Solomonic wisdom to know exactly how much of a reduction that will exert across the across the entire market. So we like the idea of a price and a limit. Either you put a cap on emissions, Or you set the price and you link it to whether emissions decline. So let's say you set that $40 a ton price and emissions don't come down. You've got a mechanism that price goes up until they start coming down. So I think prices and limits are incredibly important. And we're now beginning to see a return to that conversation in Washington, D.C. And as Steve Pakala said, if things go the way we hope and believe they'll go in the next election, I think you're going to see a flood of debate around carbon pricing and limits. So my lips to God's ears.
All right. So we'll keep I don't know where the mic is, so let's start in the back there. We'll work. I've been moving the front. Yeah.
So thank you very much for putting this on, and thanks to EDF. I've been a supporter for quite some time, and you're one of the best. There are a few great foundations, or rather nonprofits, what have you, and you guys are great, so thank you. Not to take too much time.
We appreciate your support. We appreciate all of your support.
Thank you. The title is like, How Bad Is It? So actually, I really want to know how bad is it. And the reason being, I'm in a lot of rooms around the world. I happen to, by what I do, be in rooms with, some of the ultra wealthy of this planet. And what I've recognized is most of them do not have a clue of anything that's going on. It's not out of judgment or disparagement. It's rather that they just do not know. And they do not know what to trust. And so what I'd really like to know is, no BS, like, how bad is it? And what are things that are actually occurring, which we can say, like, this is demonstrably a ramification of what's occurring in the climate. I have a fair amount of knowledge of things, but I just want to get a much deeper dive for the benefit of this conversation. Thank you.
I'll start. So it's really serious. All right? The change is everywhere. You look for it, you'll find it. Whether it's the water usage here in California and the patterns of water usage, whether it's the composition of forests in New Hampshire, I can show you the changes there. I've been monitoring 30 years. I thought that was outside. What I would see from climate would be not my lifetime. You know, I wrote papers that said, here's how it will change. No, it's what I'm seeing now. And if you go to other parts, I've spent some time in Mongolia. I'm watching the permafrost there. We were talking about the tundra. You know, it's melting. You watch the buildings turning sideways. You watch the nomadic peoples who live there struggling with the changing climate. So it's real. It's happening. And it will continue to happen independent of what we do. All we can hope to do is to reduce it and get people to recognize this is real. You can buffer yourself, but you can't prevent it from happening. You can buffer if you're wealthy, but you can't buffer everything. And I'll just do one anecdote and then turn it over to Steve. I did an exhibit about 10 years ago now of climate change impacts, telling stories about people. And we had one of the people, we did one for New England and one for North Carolina. And the one in New England, we included maple syrup production. I like the forests. I like maple syrup. So we got a farmer who personally had been making maple syrup at his sugar bush for 50 years. And he had a chart that he had over his evaporator where he marked the first day he started, the last day he finished the season, that for 50 years. And I brought it to our exhibit designer, and I said, this is fabulous. We got to use this. And he said, wow, it's a wonderful artifact, but what does this have to do with climate change? And I said, if you look at the pattern, and we pointed it out, every year it got earlier and earlier and ended earlier. And he was able to continue to make as much syrup because he kept bringing more and more technology. He brought in lines. He brought in a suction, so he's putting a vacuum on it. So he kept doing that. The point was he was going to fall off a cliff, and his grandchildren would not, even if they owned that land, would not have a commercially viable sugar bush without a doubt. And what we tried to tell the stories was, whether you were a lobsterman in New England, whether you were making maple syrup, whether you lived near a river, it was not going to be viable in the future. And we've seen, I'll just do one other anecdote. For I own a piece of forest land. It's my place to get away. I've had the privilege Steve's come and visit me there. And I put in a road up into my land just to get up. It's very narrow. Put it up, put some culverts in. Last year, we washed out those. Never had a problem. Twice last year, the rainstorms were so intense, the most intense in the 60 years we collected at the research site I work at. It washed the road out. I've had to pull all those culverts and put in bigger culverts because the rainfall patterns have changed. I can demonstrate it quantitatively. I've written a paper about it. It's changing. We're seeing that kind of change all around us, and that's not the worst of it. So it's very real, and it will get worse because of the momentum in the system, sea level rise. So you have to convince people, whether it's telling the narratives, whether it's taking them to places and showing the changes, whether it's showing them the glaciers melting, we have to do all of that. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I want to add just a little bit about a subject of tipping points that came out before. The analogy I always like is that when you were a kid, you were afraid that there were monsters in your closet or under your bed that might come out into the room. And as scientists who study this sort of thing, we actually know that there are monsters. And they're real, right? And there are a lot of them. And the problem is we don't know for most of them when they're going to come into the room very well, all right? And it's very rough calculations that say, that lead to a 2-degree or a 1.5-degree target. Those targets are formulated to try to avoid the monsters. But the current science is that some of them are probably among us. They just haven't sort of presented themselves very well. You know, the hurricane scale goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's because there wasn't a need for 6 and 7. And there are now, all of our science says that a Category 7 hurricane is now possible to hit the U.S. East Coast. Skyscrapers aren't designed to handle the wind pressures from that sort of an event. And there has been such an event in the Pacific that didn't hit land. Okay? And so the science of hurricane attribution has come on like gangbusters over the last 2 years, so that you've probably all read about Hurricane Harvey's rainfall and, you know, all the other hurricane attributions that have been done. That's an example where there's probably a monster among us, and more are going to come into the room. And that's why there's so much urgency. All right? We got to keep as many as possible under the bed as we can.
Yep, go ahead.
I think yep.
We have. Sorry, okay. I'm confused. I don't know what I'm getting.
Who's got a mic?
All right, you've got a mic there, okay. And then a sec. Okay, there and then there. Sorry, I didn't. Go ahead.
So I wanted to ask a little bit more about methane, and you mentioned this being an important part of a sustainable future where you'd have renewable solar and wind to kind of take care of things when they're available, and then that is the backup. And so I'm wondering, if we're trying to transition to a zero-carbon economy, how good are the capture techniques, and what's the prognosis? Like, are these things that can come out very, very well, very soon, and capture 90%, or is it more marginal?
So the current post-combustion capture technology captures around 90%. So it means for a true net zero economy, a fully clean economy, you have to do some negative emissions with them. There's a new power plant design that is now running in Houston, has been since July. You should look it up on the web. It's a company called Net Power. It's a thing called an alum cycle. And it's a power plant design that captures all of its CO2 and doesn't have any air pollution emissions of any kind. Doesn't even have a smokestack. Okay, really cool, and it also emits potable water. You can drink it, right? So I think there's the strong possibility of going from 90% to 100%. But we've already done quite a bit of this. This is a mature technology now. We know what it costs, and we know how to do it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about China. I know in this country, coal's on the downswing, and we're getting renewables and. Natural gas is cheaper, and so things are looking pretty good. And 20 years ago or so, Dan Dudek from EDF opened up an office in China. I know you've been there, Steve, but are they still burning more and more coal, or what's the prognosis for China?
So I'm certainly not a China expert. Unfortunately, did put a lot more carbon in the atmosphere going to China 3 times last year to work on those issues. They realized that...
We saw each other last year.
Yes, we were in China at the same time even, for different reasons. But they recognize that coal is not going to be the salvation of the Chinese economy. It's an important part right now, but they can't keep burning more, and they've got to eventually burn less. Why do I say that? Why do I believe that? Obviously, it's a very authoritarian government, and so you're not sure the words match the deeds. One of the things that's very clear in China is air pollution is a big political liability. Every politician in China knows they have to reduce air pollution if they want to keep their job. It's reported everywhere. You can look it up anywhere. You can go on your phone. You can see accurate data on particulate pollution in China right now. And they can't get there with the coal economy they've got. They've reduced the pollution from electrical, but that's only a small portion. You go to Beijing. I was there a year ago, just about today. And on a cold night, it's illegal to burn coal in your home. You can smell the coal because they don't have adequate heat, and they aren't. So they go on the black market, buy the coal, and they burn it. And that's in Beijing, where you have some of the biggest improvement throughout the country. So they know they have to reduce coal usage, and the primary driver is air quality, but also ultimately climate as well, because they're getting really clobbered. I'm not an expert. As you said, Dan Dudek went there even more 25 years ago to open the office. But we are seeing a lot of leadership by China. And it's, again, the old Reagan adage, right? Trust but verify. That's why a satellite's important on methane. We'll have the data. Because right now I cannot get the data in China. So do we have... Okay.
Just a follow-up to the question on permafrost. Will your satellite be monitoring methane from the permafrost?
We'll be able to see it, but not in the winter. We need to use natural light. So, of course, in the winter, there's no light to do it. We are not focused on that. We've made the mission explicitly focused on oil and gas. However, so that's where we start. We will be collecting data on other methane sources. As we get our arms around one, we'll move on to the next, and we'll collect as much. We don't anticipate it will be the best tool for the Arctic because the current indications are that, you know, there isn't a lot of change. But, yes, we should be able to, in certain seasons, see methane flux from the Arctic. But, again, we're going to stay focused, not trying to do everything at once. So we'll start with oil and gas. As soon as we get our arms around that, we'll be moving on to things like agriculture, landfills, and natural systems.
And before everybody feels all warm and fuzzy about the Arctic permafrost, I want to make clear that there are two Arctic permafrost problems. The one Steve is referring to is the methane problem. And there isn't an indication that there's a catastrophic release of methane from northern soils yet. Is not. The second problem, though, is the second problem is the CO2 problem. That right now, annually, we release, as a species, all in something like 50 billion metric tons of CO2 annually. There are 3 trillion tons of CO2 locked up in undecomposed organic matter in high-latitude soils for the same reason that the vegetables in your refrigerator don't rot. All right? That's why you put them in the cold, so that animals don't eat, bacteria don't eat them, and turn them into CO2. So since we've turned on the heat, left the fridge door open in the Arctic, some of that material is now rotting, and CO2 is escaping to the atmosphere. And that's a positive feedback. The more that's released, the warmer it gets, the warmer it gets, the more that's released. So that's another one of these monsters behind the door. And in contrast to the methane problem, there are measurements that non-virtuous autocatalytic cycle has started. Now, it doesn't look like it's reached a runaway point yet, but we really don't know precisely, all right?
So, sorry, I don't know where there's the mic. Thanks. Why don't you guys handle the mic, because I'm all right, yeah. You do it, and then next.
Keep raise going. Your hand. When
you've got the mic, go ahead.
Well, thank you again for this. And I have a question that I think I can gather how you would answer this, and I know how I'd answer this, but I was posed it recently, and I am curious how you would phrase your response regarding addressing climate change quickly versus equitably.
Well, I'll take a first crack and then turn to Steve. I don't think you can do it. You will be able to do it if it's not equitable. So if we can't find an equitable way of doing it, you will not get social support, and you'll see the yellow vests of Paris. I think we see that in other places. So we have to find an equitable way of doing it. What I think what Steve described is I agree with Steve. I'm seeing that reality for the first time in the last couple of years, a real thing, that we can find a path. It's not about making energy so expensive that it becomes inherently inequitable, or denying developing countries the right to have the access to light. I've spent time in villages in India where, you know, if you have one light bulb, you're doing well. You know, a few more would really help them, and really they benefit from it. We got to do both. There's no, if we won't, we will fail without equity. So I don't know if you want anything, Steve.
Yeah, the simple, that's why I focus so strongly on cost, right? It's that it's just unethical to keep people who are struggling financially, to keep them struggling if you have an alternative. And it's doubly unethical to keep the desperately poor of the world poor, all right, when they haven't created this problem. So that's why it's so important that we have inexpensive solutions now.
Hi. Over
okay.
here.
All right, I was going to go to somebody in the back.
Oh, okay.
I'll be next.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, two things. We're going to lose another 2 years with Trump in power, so I wanted you to address what we can do about that, if that, you know, is really, really serious, and if there are ways around that. And secondly, Steve Snyder, a leading global warming researcher, said that the reason the models keep falling short of how bad things are is because of the positive feedback loops, of which you referred to one in the permafrost. And how serious are the positive feedback loops in terms of how serious things are?
I'll take the first part. Let Steve handle the second part. So in terms of the next 2 years, it is what it is. But that's one of the reasons when literally the day after Eric was on the call, we talked and we didn't bat an eyelash to hire more lawyers and take more of the generosity in this room to get those lawyers to fight in court to ensure that every inch that they took away from us, we were going to fight every bit of it. And so we have succeeded. I know methane best. I don't know the full legal portfolio, and I'm going to look to Joel and Eric if they want to jump in on that. But certainly in methane, the first loss that Trump experienced in the Senate on the CRA, they didn't get the repeal of the BLM methane rule because it went down to failure in the Senate in May of 2017. We were working hard for that. They have lost in the courts many times. So I sit on the Science Advisory Board of the EPA. I do what I can there. Many scientists, EPA, EDF, working in coalition with our brethren, are working to try and slow it down. But we don't have the levers of power, but do as much as we can. And remember that a lot of action, like here in California, is moving forward in other states. So there's a whole lot of positive. I don't want to sugarcoat the situation in Washington and in other capitals. So we're working around the world on these issues. You want to handle the issue of
but just to double down on the next 2 years, it's important to remember three things. First, necessity really is the mother of invention here. If you look at the executive actions that Trump used to suspend methane rules and compare them against the reductions that EDF has extracted unilaterally from companies, the latter are far stronger than the rules that were suspended. Okay, number one. Number two, the U.S. is the second biggest emitter in the world, but it's actually only 10% of global emissions, or a little bit more than 10% maybe, but not much more than 10% more than global emissions now. And so the rest of the world hasn't stopped the way we have. They haven't had the same kind of hiccup that we have. And the third thing is that if there are a lot of studies that have done this, if you actually try to cost out and plan out the build of an alternative infrastructure, energy infrastructure in the U.S., we do have time to come out as a world leader still. So this has been a suspension, and it's been a delay that came at a very bad time. But this game is very far from over. On the positive feedback loops, virtually every monster behind the door that I'm scared of is a positive feedback loop. Steve Schneider was a dear friend before he was killed. We talked about this many, many times before he died. We talked about this many times. We could talk maybe offline about, you know, the rogues gallery of the mall.
Hi. This is the Environmental Defense Fund. I want to know what your feelings are about the plastics in the water, in the oceans, in rivers and streams and lakes. I mean, everything that we touch these days, most everything, is made of plastic. And it doesn't go away. It doesn't break down. You know, it's there, and it's horrible. So I want to know your feelings on that, because it's environment.
Sure. Great Thank question. You. And 2 days ago, for our board and our staff, we held what we do twice a year called Science Day. It was on the plastics issue. We brought in 7 of the leading experts on plastics. We spent 5 hours talking about it. I wish I had an easy answer for you, okay? I don't. But we have been involved in working. We do a lot of work with supply chains, and we've started working. How do we get the plastics out of as many products as we can? And that's an answer I'm going to punt, and I'm going to say I'll answer it next year. We'll do something again, and I'll give you an answer. I don't know the answer. We spent time in the Science Advisory Committee, which Steve serves on, talking about this issue. Like other groups, we agree with you. It's an enormous challenge. We've worked some on it. That's not enough. And I don't have a clean answer. We're trying to figure out where the levers are to help reduce it.
One of the problems is that it's not a localized issue. It's worldwide.
Understood.
The oceans are like international.
Sure. But it's not even just in oceans. We all in this room have plastics in us. All right.
Yes.
We are generating those plastics with our every time you stick your fleece thing in the dryer, you're sending those out into the environment. It's in the soil, it's in the air, and it's in the oceans. Absolutely. And the real worrisome parts of it to me isn't what you can see. It's those nanoparticles you can't see.
The ones that
are getting down deep into your lungs.
And not only us, but in flora and fauna.
Absolutely.
And fish and
Absolutely.
Wildlife. You know.
In the back is our next one. Thank you.
This is kind of back to the question of how we respond to the skeptics and the deniers. I live in Pacifica. We have a weekly local newspaper, the Pacifica Tribune, which has recently taken on a fairly regular columnist who has some kind of scientific background, I'm not sure what it is, and a naturalist. In his column yesterday, he was making the argument that made it clearer than ever that he is a climate change skeptic. He talks about fish and the Pacific decadal oscillation as one example of the benefits of climate change that he relates to what has gone on for eons. I'm not qualified to respond in a letter to the editor to this kind of statement, but I'm curious whether you have any advice or can suggest someone who might want to respond. The paper is right here. Thank you.
The business with the deniers, which is a uniquely American phenomenon, has been it's uniquely American in its scope and scale. Okay, it's not unique in the existence of deniers. Every scientific debate has people on the other side. Okay, the problem is when financially interested groups decide to back a losing side of an argument. There are Nobel Prize-winning scientists who believed far longer than they should have that HIV didn't cause AIDS. There were Nobel Prize-winning scientists who fought the idea of continental drift far beyond the time when what happens in scientific debates, it's so adversarial that eventually the opposition all dies. All right? It's really true. And so the shiny credentialed opposition eventually just died. It's a demographic phenomenon, right? And so that's what's, to be honest, that's what's going on here now, right, in the U.S. And the thing is that fortunately, with just steady and relentless refutation and the accumulation of a truly compelling, multidimensional body of evidence, doesn't stand on any one body. All these these internal checks from different directions. Public opinion really is changing in the United States and in the right direction. The most recent poll on this, done by a group at Yale, showed the biggest change ever in absolutely the most critical metric. Not just is climate change happening, but are you personally being damaged by it? All right? And so that war is being won, but the last shiny credentialed one, who's a denier, will die. That's all.
Okay. Do we have time?
There's no stop. You got to wait, right?
Yeah. And the key is, as Steve said, is that we build the momentum, and as Eric talked about, that things, there is evidence to have some hope that there's growing political will. I don't want to sugarcoat it, but there is signs that if we all put our shoulder to the wheel, and that can happen. There's a question here. It's next. And
yeah, me.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Can you please address the human health impacts of climate change, the rise in infectious diseases, and so forth? And I'm always surprised, honestly, that discussion of the human health impacts is almost an afterthought when it seems like it really is the framing of climate change that makes it more relatable to most people and might get people closer to the answer of how big of a deal is this.
So health impacts is certainly a big deal, and I'll just use an anecdote to just tee it up. So I had the opportunity quite a while ago in 1995 to be heavily involved in the second assessment report of the IPCC, so that's 24 years ago. And I was asked to help do the briefing when we released it at the White House, and because that was the first time there had been a chapter, this was in the second, on health impacts, almost all the questions were on health impacts. So I concur, it's real. I'm not an expert in the health impacts, and I'm not a health scientist. But part of the challenge has been to really make it real is it's hard to make those projections. There's so many variables. So we still, unfortunately, don't have the full ramification of those, of what the health impacts will be. And so that's still a lot of uncertainty in that domain. Are they real? Absolutely. We're seeing things like, we can't totally tie it down. You look at things like Lyme disease, changing patterns of ticks. If you live on the East Coast, you know about this if you spend any time in nature. And, they're changing rapidly. Distributions are changing. It's a little hard to tell how much of this is our various dogs dropping ticks versus climate, but the signal's there. You can do the same thing with other diseases. It's real. It's happening. And I apologize. I just don't know enough to give you the concrete answers on the state of knowledge. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of several dire human impacts, and it is a good one to make people understand the seriousness. I'd argue that it's no more serious than disruption in tropical food supply, right? It's pretty serious. And so there are a lot of serious impacts here. There are fantastic people working on this. The signal, particularly for vector-borne diseases, is extremely strong already. There are all kinds of diseases in the United States that are much more prevalent because of the the documented increase in the number of heat events. West Nile white virus is a great example where it actually only becomes dangerous during heat waves, and heat waves are now three times more common, where the disease is a big problem. There are all kinds of people in the hospital. The science is good enough to say, yeah, chances are two and three that person's in the hospital because of climate change when they have West Nile white, for instance. So it's a big deal. If you keep an eye on Berkeley's events, look for a lecture by a guy named Solomon Shang, Shaing. I'm giving him a plug. He doesn't know it, but he's about the best in the business on this. All right? So,
thank you. I think you also have to include ICU, increase in ICU visits from asthma attacks during inhalation of wildfire smoke, and all of that is all relevant.
Right. Just to not to overpaint it, right? The problem is they're complicating. It gets complicated with air pollution exposure and changing patterns, and those aren't all climate. So sorting that out can be difficult. So just we have to be careful in saying everything's climate. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but there are complex patterns here. I don't. Where's that?
Where's
you got the
mic?
Next? Perfect.
It's not easy to have humans stop and think and be able to observe their way of thinking and make an adjustment. And you're stating facts and you're taking stands that I just really appreciate. So if we can just take a step forward in our thinking and adjust it where we might get to. And it's not easy in this world because our thoughts are so well formed and we believe them, not that they're right, but we just do. So I want to thank you for both of your stands and the facts and taking these kinds of questions and helping us as humans and on our planet move forward.
Well, it's greatly appreciated. Your comments. And one of the things, I'm going to say this, and I am going to, I apologize, I'm going to tout our horn at EDF a little bit, but one of the things we agree, thinking about change and how we think as people, you know, is hard, and we recognize that people change. So we made an investment now, I think it's 7 years ago, and we hired a social psychologist, PhD social psychologist, on our team to make sure that we could understand how people react to information. Right? The old academic thing, and I come out of that, you know, just say it louder and more often, and it'll be, everybody will listen. Yeah, it doesn't work so well. It doesn't change. So we now, he has a whole team. We do experiments. He works with Eric extensively. And we actually try and understand. So when we released our maps in Oakland on air pollution, we looked at how people react because we wanted them to use it. We didn't want to cause fear. We wanted that information to become a tool, a powerful tool of understanding so people could reach their own aspirations. And we try and use that information so that we can more effectively reach out and use that data. We're not telling you what to think. It's not about brainwashing, but it's trying to make sure that when you see it, we can use it. And I openly say when we did our first maps on methane, every instinct I had was wrong. I didn't know how to communicate it. I used the wrong colors. I presented the wrong metaphors. But we had a great team. We tested it. We learned that. And I learned to be quiet and let them lead. Where's the... Oops, back there.
Okay. Hi. Yeah, so my education is in computing and mathematics, and I don't know about you, but my university, there were not a lot of courses in environmental computing. Can you recommend some ways in which people, I'm working data science and data analysis, can you recommend some ways in which someone like me can get involved in working on this problem? I have two other questions as well. The other second question is what books would you recommend? And then the third question is it really, I mean, if natural gas is the best stable solution, is that really if I understood you correctly, if that's the firm energy source, it's not a very safe one, is it? I mean, what's a safer alternative?
So I'll handle the natural gas question first. It's wrong to think of the mix that I described as the solution that's going to be with humanity forever,
What it is the solution mix which is available today, which can take us to 100% clean. That is zero greenhouse gas, you know, net emissions. So it doesn't make global warming any worse. It's the first solution. It's the one that we have time to implement if we're going to reach the stringent targets that we think are so necessary.
And do
that
it
doesn't
equitably.
Mean it'll be the next.
And do it equitably.
And do it equitably. That's right. And do it at a cost that doesn't cripple. But that doesn't mean that once that generation, you know, as soon as you put that in the ground, that it won't start to, you know, that fantastically low-cost, ginormous batteries won't replace those as a firm source of power, all right? It's just that those aren't available now, and we don't have time to wait for them, right? And so that's the point, right?
And I'll just add on that one thing, that gas isn't the bulk of it. It's a piece of it. We're still talking about a lot of renewables. Right, that's the bulk of the electrical generation. It's just how do you close the gap between what it can do and zero?
And you want to maximize the amount of renewables consistent with not letting the cost get out of control, because that's a social justice issue too, right? On data science, let's talk afterwards, because there's a lot that's done in environmental computing.
Yeah. I don't
Here.
Know who's got... Sorry.
And just due to time, this might have to be the last question that we take, but if you guys want to write down any questions that you may have, we can take those on your way out, and we'd be happy to answer them.
And I'm not... I'll speak for Steve, but I think we'll be happy to stick around for a little while.
I'd like to help expedite the demise of the climate deniers.
Without breaking any moral code, please. Okay.
Yes. So my question is
Second Amendment rights.
So my question is, has the EDF had communications with ExxonMobil?
Yes. So we work right now with a wide range of oil and gas companies. There's work we're doing with them. They were co-sponsors on something called the Mobile Methane Monitoring Challenge. It was joint with Stanford, so it's Stanford EDF Challenge. They were one of the partners in that to find better technology to detect faster, better, more accurately methane using mobile sources, either drones, cars, things like that. So we do work with them. But as I always, when I first joined EDF, I was impressed on something that I learned when I first joined. We were working very closely with Duke Energy on low carbon solutions, and we were suing them at the same time. So the fact that we're working with Exxon doesn't mean we agree with them everything. Doesn't mean we aren't going to be pushing them really hard in other ways. But where we can work together, we have, yes.
Well, I'd like to propose that everybody that really cares about what you've been talking about this evening makes the pledge to divest themselves of any direct or indirect form of investment in ExxonMobil, and also to boycott them, because they're not going to really do the things we want in a time frame we're talking about unless it hurts their pocketbooks.
Yeah, I'll leave that without comment. Go ahead, Derek.
So it might be worth mentioning, I think people can hear me, that EDF is completely divested from all fossil fuels extraction, no investments in fossil fuels, period.
So was that it, or do we have time? We have our minders, so...
Or one more.
All right, I'm patiently at the front here. I apologize. I know there were people who tried and... It's very gratifying, the amount of conversation and questions. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to everyone.
I have two questions, and I'll try to be brief. January is the season every year when all the investment advisors and asset managers hold their annual forums to talk about what the economy has in store for us this year and in ensuing years. I go every year for one or two of these, and I've just finished going to two. I don't think I've ever heard a single word about climate problems. What can be done to bring the discussion we're having today, or generally about climate problems, global warming, etc., into the dialogue where all the people who have money are thinking about how to invest it? That's my first question. Second question is one about the proposal that's been going around now for a few years about taxing at the source carbon-bearing products and then distributing the tax as a dividend across the entire country equally. I know it's had some legs in Canada, though I'm not sure exactly where it stands now. But what do you think of that proposal, and do you know where it, how it's progressing here?
So I'll take on the first one, and I don't know, Eric, you up for the second one? So Eric will answer the second one. So the first one is, I would encourage you, this is just my personal, again, I'm a scientist, so I'm not an economist, and I don't do investments, is you need to bring that to the conversations when you go, because you're the audience, they'll respond. And I think you're more powerful than you think. If everyone in this room, with every advisor you've got, say, well, I've done it with mine, I'm not willing to invest in this, this, and this. I care about these things, and I don't expect you to call me up with any advice that doesn't have that in it. They take note. Now, what EDF does, because we're not working on the retail level like that, is we actually work with investors on the macro scale so that they're asking those questions. The big firms, not at the retail, but at the what are they investing in the fund, and where we've had a lot of success. Let's say, well, I'll use methane. We're working with the investors. We wrote a report to get, I'm not going to get the right number. I'm looking at Joel. He's really good at these numbers. Was it $2 trillion? I don't remember. But investing a very large sum of money where they would be asking every fossil fuel company, what are you doing and what is your position? Are you controlling your methane emissions? And basically making clear they're going to get dinged if they're not. And I guarantee you that that gets noticed. So every CEO of every major gas company at the World Gas Conference in June talked about the need to address methane. And that came from the work we've been doing to push this issue, the work the investors are doing because they're saying that. So we got to work this top, from the top down, for the big institutional investors. You've got to work it. You have a responsibility. You have more power than you think to bring that issue up every time you ask a question. Are you investing my values? And here are my values. I think it really can make a difference.
And make no mistake, the corporate risk officers know all about this and bring it up constantly. If you get a chance, take a look at the op-ed piece in the New York Times, I believe it was Tuesday, by Bob Litterman, who is got a lovely home in Hillsborough, had dinner with him on Monday night. And he was the person who built Goldman Sachs's risk management strategy. They still use the Litterman model, and he's actually part of a big group of risk managers who make this case. So take a look at that, and you'll see the group that is actually working actively from within corporate America to bring these risks to current decision making.
There's another investor and money manager who's worth reading on this subject, a guy named Jeremy Grantham, who some of you may be familiar with, who writes a quarterly letter that invariably includes issues of climate change and resource scarcity that will result from climate change. To the question about the idea of a tax that's rebated back to people, that is a live debate. There's an organization called the Citizens Climate Lobby that is it's quite influential and driving that idea, and that idea does have support. There are some, I'll speak personally now, some philosophical issues about the idea of rebating the funds from a carbon tax at the same level to every individual in the country, and it's an equity issue because every individual in the country is not going to be impacted equally by the cost of decarbonization. If you happen to live in the Pacific Northwest, where you get most or all of your electricity from hydro, why should you get a check for decarbonization if you happen to live in Ohio, where you're electricity is generated by coal, your costs are going to go up a lot more. And so I personally would favor a model that delivers the funds to the people who really need it. I think that's the essence of equity. There is a political argument to be made for giving it equally to everybody. I welcome the day when we have that debate on Capitol Hill.
Okay. So on that note, I want to thank everyone for coming, and importantly, I want to thank you all for your support. We could not do the work that we do without it. EDF is no stronger than its members and its supporters, and it's been a real privilege to be able to work on behalf of the 2 million members on this work, and I certainly feel like, in terms of ending my career, the last phase of it, to be able to do this has been a real privilege. I know we didn't get to everyone's questions, so there's an opportunity to please write them down. We'll get back to you. I apologize. The good news was there was lots of enthusiasm in the room, and we're happy to stay and continue for a little while. I wish you a great night, and again, thank you so much for being supporters.